If Gary and Mike can come up and join Emily at the podium, we will take some questions. But before we do, I'd like to throw out, through the years of having been on these panels or fielded phone calls after Grand Rounds lectures, I know there are a lot of scenarios that many of you have faced in practice, and this is often an opportunity to hear what the experts might do. So I've prepared a few of those questions to sort of throw out to them, but I would be more than happy to be interrupted at any time. So Mike, clearly prevention is better than any type of repair. Is there a scenario where a general surgeon, a good experienced general surgeon, has enough information to not do a cholecystectomy and refer it to a tertiary care facility? Specifically, the role of other options. You mentioned a surgeon who you admired stuck the scope in a couple times and just backed out without doing any harm. Talk a little bit about the preoperative judgment of tough cholecystectomies.
Yeah, it's really a great question. I think, was it Ben Franklin that said that? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, maybe. I think there are, we know what risk factors are for a more difficult cholecystectomy. But many times we don't know the level of those, the impact of those factors on the operation until sometimes you get in the operating room. But there are some things. Markedly thickened gallbladder wall, long-standing history of multiple episodes or, you know, severe acute cholecystitis, the shrunken contracted gallbladder. I think one that we don't see very often, but maybe is best handled in a specialty center is Maritzi syndrome. I think that's a very dangerous scenario for a couple reasons. One is the bile duct and hepatocystic triangle can be really tethered fused, but you can also actually have a biliary fistula between the gallbladder and the bile duct that's complicated to imagine. So that's one. And I think, you know, patients with moderate cirrhosis, they're just higher risk in general. So I think if you have that patient in one of those categories, you have to really think about what's your comfort level, experience, expertise. We know that the vast majority of cholecystectomies in the world are done not in the academic centers, they're the referral centers, they're done in the community hospitals. And so many general surgeons have a lot more experience doing cholecystectomies and even difficult ones than in the academic centers. But those would be some of the red flags that I think you would want to worry about. And I think the important sort of cultural shift for us is if you get into the operating room and you put the scope in and you look and or you get started into the dissection and things are just too difficult, there's no shame in backing out and coming back and fighting the battle the other day or sending it to someone else or to your partner or whoever. So I think that's probably one of the most important things we can do culturally is not feel like because we started the operation, as long as you haven't burned bridges, that you have to persist.
Gary, you have a comment?
Well, I echo what you said. You said it so completely. I just want to bring out two little scenarios. Your question was, is there a scenario when you don't even put the scope in, just send it on? And I think to a bigger center, I think when there's concomitant medical problems that the patient has and a CT or whatever imaging shows a gallbladder that looks like a bomb went off and you're in a medium or smaller community, I get those calls and we take them because they just don't feel comfortable with what they think is going to be a complicated operation and they've got a sick patient. I tend to agree with the comment that the people in the community are really good at cholecystectomy now, the good surgeons and in the medium-sized hospitals, and they do take on the most difficult cholecystectomies. I had a patient sent this past week, actually. The doctor stuck the scope in, dissected a little bit, and he called in the operating room and said, you know, I've never done this in my 30 years, he said, of just not even wanting to open or try any further. I have sent some on to you, but this one, I just think we ought to pull the scope out and send them. And so I think that comment that when you get in there, if it just doesn't look right, there's no shame in it. That patient came, did well. We thought for sure we'd have to open because this was a very, you know, good surgeon. We decided to try it laparoscopic, and actually we're able to get it out laparoscopic without any sense of danger. It went very well. But sometimes it just takes another pair of hands, a little more aggressiveness, because you are the final stop, and the things can be done carefully. So that concept, I do think, as long as the patient is not medically unfit,
That video that you showed, where you know it was sort of like waiting for a NASCAR crash to happen when they cut the common bile duct and did the IOC. So let's just say you're sitting in your office in St. Louis, and that surgeon is 20 miles away in an outpatient center doing a lap coli. He did an IOC, and clearly has no filling of the proximal bile duct. You know that he's identified a major bile duct injury about to happen. What would you advise him to do? He looked like they continued on laparoscopically. Should you advise most surgeons to open at that time? And if they do, what do they do with that, what looked like a generous choledochotomy that they'd made with the scissors to introduce their IOC catheter?
So I think you have to realize what your skill set and comfort level is. I think the principles that I talked about, once you've incurred an injury, I would always try to get somebody else, another set of eyes, to come in and look. How do you think we ought to do this? Or get on the phone and call somebody. This was happened to be a very skilled, advanced MIS surgeon. So what they ended up doing was actually repairing the injury and leaving a drain. And I think the patient ended up doing okay. But what I would encourage is to not proceed with the operation if you don't get proximal filling. There are things you can do. You can put the patient in Trendelenburg. You can give morphine to contract the sphincter to make sure it's not a problem, you know, with just contrast is just going right into the duodenum. But you don't want to leave the operating room under those circumstances. And if you're not comfortable, if you think you've incurred a significant injury, I think we're really feel now it's probably best to just stop, put a drain in, even with the gallbladder still in situ, and then send that patient. If you've got a minor lateral ductal injury and you have the ability to finely suture that with a 4-0 or 5-0 absorbable suture, then I think it's fine to do that. I would still leave a drain and follow that patient very carefully, or then get them to a referral center.
I'm going to get to you in a second, Gary, but the chances are the worst thing that will happen in that situation is they'll get a stricture and somebody like Gary can come in and do an endoscopic dilatation with what looks like to be a 90 to 100% successful outcome. Gary, your thoughts?
What I was going to say is my experience with these among our own faculty, residents, and the state, because a lot of incisional injuries do occur with leaks. The problem is not the size of the choledochotomy, although obviously if there's loss of tissue or devascularization, the issue is the amount of dissection that occurred before you made that because you thought it was the cystic duct. And there's a very high rate of stricture of those. So we recommend that if you've done a repair, particularly a lot of them get repaired over a small T-tube, is that when you're ready to take the T-tube out, send them to us endoscopically. A little guide wire can be passed down, which reduces the rate of pancreatitis to near zero. Do a small sphincterotomy, place a little stent, and let that thing heal after the removal for a while over the tube. And the stricture rate is minimal. But I've a lot of them, the guys pull them, and then 6 months later, they are back with a stricture, probably not because of the choledochotomy repair and the size suture material or anything. It's just the vascular injury to the area.
So before I take that question, I want to throw this to Emily, because in your new role as hepatobiliary director for the MedStar system, which makes up much of the Maryland, D.C. area, you're going to get a lot of these calls. So what do you tell the surgeon who knows they've now cut the bile duct? They still haven't they've transected it, they've recognized it, the gallbladder's still in, and they either are not personally comfortable, there's nobody in their hospital who's comfortable in doing a repair. What are you going to tell that surgeon?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful just to have that conversation right in the operating room, because often I think it's hard for people to relate what they saw, but often a picture is very helpful. So I generally, I don't really care so much if a tube is put up the duct or anything like that. I think a drain in the abdomen right up under the porta hepatis, and maybe two drains. Sometimes people put one up under the left lateral section and one anterior to the porta, and then stop. I don't think you have to take the gallbladder out, but if the gallbladder's hanging there and disconnected, it actually is nicer to take it out in the event the repair is going to be delayed. I don't think it's any downside to the patient to do that at all. If you put a tube in the duct, we can sometimes use it for a cholangiogram, but I think it's fancier than you need to be, and often just then people clip, and it just turns out to be more work than it's, I think, benefit overall.
I believe there's somebody at the microphone in the back. I can't identify you, so if you just want to ask your question, that's fine.
Hi, Brian Organ, Atlanta. Dr. Winslow, after these complex reconstructions, how do you follow these patients with ultrasound, LFTs, Q6 months for 2 or 3 years, and how long out do you follow them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I don't always, but if I have a percutaneous tube in place, I leave it there and get a cholangiogram before, after the patient's gone home. So usually around 3 to 4 weeks, pull out the tube after a normal cholangiogram. And then after that, I follow them with liver function test only, really, unless there was something difficult about the repair or a part of the liver I knew was not well drained or infarcted. And I do that every 6 months for the first 2 years and then annually thereafter, but there's no data to support that. And I try to do it forever, honestly, because these are young people that really, I'd rather know about the trend up in the liver enzymes in time to stent and dilate before they really get a complete obstruction.
I'll just give a quick case scenario. A patient had a hepaticogegeation ostomy repaired at a good facility and had a dilatation of that a year later, was sent to Louisville with some, I don't remember the details, but I was actually a faculty member then, got a dilatation by our interventional radiologist, did not come back for follow-up, came back 30 years later, this past year, same interventional radiologist is still working, and she remembered him, and had a stricture again. And I think Henry Pitt's data, published in the 80s, really supports the idea that these strictures can occur late, 30 years plus. So I do think a lifetime follow-up of simple liver functions, because alkaline will go up first, and then bilirubin, you can avoid biliary cirrhosis.
Question in the front row.
Yeah, Mark Ott from Intermountain.
I thought it was Mark. I couldn't say for sure.
I'm just curious how you handle the situation. I ended up fixing a significant number of these in the Intermountain West, and obviously, more often than not, I know the surgeon who he or she's very good, and you get to know the patient and the family incredibly well over the months and years you take care of them. And I'd say at least 80% of these end up in court, and I'm just curious, how do you balance, you know, the surgeon who you care about and the family that you care about in that situation, because that becomes very difficult.
So maybe I'll take a shot at that for a couple reasons. Number one, I've cut bile ducts myself, plural. I've repaired a ton of them in lots of different scenarios. And three, I've had the opportunity to defend a number of surgeons in malpractice cases. And I think, like anything, if you're the surgeon and you create the injury, you have to be honest. You need to be transparent that this was not what the desired outcome was. Whether you use the term mistake or error, that depends on what language you want to use. I think one thing you have to emphasize to the patient when you're transferring them to Emily or transferring them to you, that you're not abandoning the patient. I've had patients come up to me in transfer, say, Dr. X couldn't get rid of me fast enough. Explain to them why they're doing it. It's their best interest to be at a center with multidisciplinary team and with experience, and so that they feel that it's the transfers in their best interest. I think if you really can do something to maintain a positive relationship around a bad outcome that you feel responsible for, and try to not to create the controversy that begins right away. The other thing I feel very strongly about, and I said this on Saturday, is there better transferred to another surgeon than to the GI medicine service? Many surgeons who create an injury don't want to send their complications to a surgeon. They think that'll hurt their reputation, or the surgeon will badmouth them, and that the gastroenterologist will put a stent in, hopefully, and it'll all get better. You know, these have to be managed surgically, because the longer these patients get delayed, the more procedures, the little quote from the chat room that Mike shared with us about a patient having 30 procedures in 3 or 9 months and $300,000. I mean, get a surgical opinion involved early. I think that's important. Gary, you obviously have been in the same boat.
Yeah, I'll just say that I think surgeons are much better at talking to the patient afterwards. The number of GI guys who I really like, nice guys, who have told a patient that should never have happened is astounding. And that leads to the lawsuit. The patients are reaching out, gee, should I sue? But anyway, I think surgeons, number one, can explain the anatomy issues better and why these things could potentially happen, even in the absence of negligence. So, and I have been in the position of defending the doctors, because I do believe that bioduct injuries can occur in the absence of negligence, and then the patients being pretty upset about it. So I think you just have to take each case individually with what it is and as a treating physician.
Mike.
Yeah, I would echo those comments. So just I'll acknowledge I also had a couple of bioduct injuries early in my career when lap choly first took off. And it's a difficult thing to deal with as a surgeon. It's obviously much worse for the patient, but it's hard on us also. And that's a part of the hard part, is to be direct and honest and open with the patient. And I think where a lot of problems happen is when injuries tend to get, things get compounded. You do something beyond your skill level. The patient is not immediately referred, and our complaints are ignored for a while. And I think those are some of the most important, you know, principles. If you do what's best for the patient, then you have a much better chance of avoiding litigation in that circumstance.
One other thing I think as the receiving person is, I think it's really important to check back in with whoever made the call to you, hopefully the referring surgeon. I usually wait about 24 hours after the patient's been there and just say, hey, I just want to let you know things are going fine. This is what we're doing. You want me to send you some pictures? And I mean, I think there's a management of the patient and also of that situation that surgeon's in, outside of the legal situation, but just on a kind of personal basis. And I think that usually goes a long way to helping the patient have a relationship with that doctor as well.
Gentleman in the front.
Me? I'm assuming.
Yeah, sure. I can't see with the projector there, but yes.
Me?
Yes.
Okay. I had a question with regards to the fenestrated subtotal cholecystectomy technique. What do you do with the cystic duct opening? Because I've had partners who feel very strongly it needs to be sutured shut, and I've had some who feel that you can just leave that open with the drain.
Yeah. Excellent question. So I think the first important principle is to do what you can to get all of the stones out. You don't want to leave any stones. You don't want to leave a mini gallbladder. It's a 2 or maybe 3 centimeter cuff that you're protecting that area, the hepatocystic triangle. If you can see the cystic duct orifice, my preference would be to put a catheter in and shoot a cholangiogram and make sure everything looks okay. And if I can see it, then I'll suture it closed. You have to be careful not to go too deep with your suture, but if I can see where it is, I'll try to suture it. There's a lot of edema there, and you may not be able to see the cystic duct orifice. So if you can't see it, then I leave it and put a drain in and make sure the patient's on the diet, and probably leave the drain in for at least 4 or 5 days, because sometimes, even though there may not be any bile initially, they might get a little bit as some of the edema goes down and they get a little backflow through that. But that's how I would recommend managing.
And what about ablating the residual mucosa any way? What do you think about that? Is that safe to do? Is there any risk to right hepatic duct injury?
I wouldn't ablate it at the cuff where you open it, but if you leave the back wall of the gallbladder on, then I would ablate that. Yes.
Gentleman in the front here on the left.
Okay, in the interest of prevention, I did a little gallbladder surgery for a little over 35 years, and I always dissected starting at the fundus and down to the triangle. very safe. You could see everything. When I started doing laparoscopics and I did it the way I was taught and started down at the triangle and coming back, far more confusion and difficulties doing that. Why is that not taught, that we do laparoscopic starting at the fundus?
So the issue with the fundus first approach, laparoscopically, first of all, it's more difficult to get the proper retraction and exposure to take the gallbladder down from above. You can certainly do it, but if it's a difficult gallbladder and you've got a lot of inflammation and fusion, some of the worst combined vascular biliary injuries, I think, that the HPB surgeons see is when this top-down approach has been used. So I would urge you, it's fine for doing it open, but I would urge you to be very careful with top-down. And I think in the situation in where there is intense inflammation in the hepatocystic triangle, we believe it's better to do a subtotal than to try to do a top-down.
I think it's also easier to leave more gallbladder that way. So, I mean, we certainly all see a lot of people with remnants that thought they had their whole gallbladder removed, and the surgeon thought they had it all removed coming from the top, because you can't, unless you go too almost too far, sometimes it's difficult to know. And so I think that's another reason other than the safety aspect.
Yes, sir.
This is anecdotal comment about malpractice. In 1990, I was the one of the first who've done laparoscopic surgery in New York State. And of course, I have a lot of patients dumped on me. This particular patient, I knew her before. I knew her family. I did surgery on her. I recognized the cone bile duct injury immediately at surgery. I closed. I put her in the plane. I flew with her to Pittsburgh. At the time, Pittsburgh was one of the foremost places for transplant. And I put her in the plane, nevertheless, I got sued. So, I mean, there is no foul play. Even if you know the patient, if you are honest, if you are, you've done everything, and as you said, it was more taxing on me emotionally, probably than the patient, but still, you got sued. It was settled. Thank you.
Could I make one comment, since we're talking about the legal issues of whether they were successful in their suit, depends a lot on what you write in your op note. Because to do a critical view or dissect out the triangle of Calot in detail, and then you have an op note that says, identify the cystic duct and cystic artery, clip them and divided them, is a real problem when you're trying to defend these cases. And there are many experts, plaintiff experts, who will not take the case if it's well delineated in the op note that you met the standards for dissection. So not only do you need to do the right critical view of safety and dissection of triangle of Calot, but you have to really elucidate that in your op note very carefully. And I do think, though, in spite of your experience, I think when you are very upfront with patients, close to them, and do your best to maintain communication, there are many who will forego the legal aspect, as opposed to the patients who say to me, my doctor has never called me, he never talked to me, never asked how I did. And I think, you know, it's hard for you to make that call maybe, but I think the communication, even if they're angry at you, is still better than no communication at all.
Thanks.
So there's, oh, okay, yeah.
In this era where we're speaking more about the subtotal cholecystectomy, I wonder how many gallbladder cancers will be spilled into an abdomen. Has anyone had any experience with that?
Why don't you take that, Emily?
I was going to add earlier when we were talking about reasons to transfer. I think it's really important not to start an operation if there's asymmetric gallbladder wall thickening, any radiologist who thinks that maybe there's a mass in the gallbladder. But sometimes it's just an operative sense that something's wrong. I've taken care of about three patients who have had their gallbladder opened in the operating room, cancer only noted on the pathology, and it's a problem. Obviously, gallbladder cancer, even if resected intact, doesn't have a great prognosis, but it's certainly peritoneally at least much worse with that type of operation. So they generally get peritoneal seeding pretty rapidly. I think it's really an index of suspicion question more than a technical one. If the patient has all these preceding symptoms and it doesn't seem like acute cholecystitis, I think it's really important to think about that, that maybe this is a gallbladder cancer, because they don't always look typical on imaging.
I think that comes down to the very first question. If Mike said, if there's any concern that the wall is thickened and cancer could be in the diagnosis, certainly further workup with CT or MRI to make this diagnosis before you get into the situation where you end up having to abort after creating a cholecystostomy. So,
I think one thing we haven't mentioned is the xanthogranulomatous gallbladder, and I think that those are the cases where often people think that's what they have, but it's a gallbladder cancer. So that's definitely an error trap, I think.
Yeah.
Question. Yes, sir. Darren Chapman from Western Kentucky. Is there any data to suggest that the harmonic scalpel is safer to do this dissection? Number one, you could address the ducts of Luschka with harmonic scalpel. You're less likely to have that, possibly. And also, electrocautery may injure things that you don't want to injure.
Go ahead, Mike.
So it's a good question. The difficult acutely inflamed gallbladder, I think an ultrasonic coagulator, or some people may prefer an advanced bipolar, but an ultrasonic coagulator can be very beneficial. You have less smoke plume, so your visualization is better. It's faster. It's a little more hemostatic. And so I will certainly use it in that setting, but I don't use it dissecting in that lower area of the hepatocystic triangle, because that, if you've ever put your hand on the ultrasonic after it's activated, it gets extremely hot, and so you can get thermal injuries with it. But for taking the gallbladder off the bed in a difficult inflamed situation, it can be very beneficial.
So one last question, and I'm going to direct this to Gary. There's some young surgeons here, some residents, perhaps people who will be taking their American Board of Surgery exam sometime in the next 2 or 3 years, and my guess that question will still be there. Patient presents 5 days after a lap chole, nausea, distended, uncomfortable, low-grade fever. How's that patient best worked up, and what are the and just bullet point steps that should be done?
Well, I think the first thing is, and this is the most important, don't send them home from the ER, and make sure that you have instructed the people who answer the phone calls for you in the office know if someone's had a cholecystectomy and they call what sound like very mild symptoms that you want to be informed. There are many cases where twice they call the office and twice they're referred to send home and made an appointment 7 days later. So make sure you get those phone calls to kind of think through it. It's very subtle for many patients in the beginning. And honestly, I think one of the best things is a very early HIDA scan. I think a CT scan is useful, looking for major fluid throughout the abdominal cavity. I don't think the blood tests answer the question right away. HIDA scan turns out to be very sensitive for small leaks, but you want to identify that there is a leak or a problem very early on at 4 to 5 days. Once you determine that that is the case, then you want to define the anatomy. I think that there are very exceptional cases where you just rush in to operate.
You'll likely fail the exam if I'm your examiner if you rush into the operating
room. Pardon? Yeah. I mean, barring gross peritonitis where you may have to do a washout, but you really want to define the anatomy with either ERCP or PTC. Remember, ERCP does have a risk of pancreatitis, so you don't want to do it unless you really need it. And I think the second step then is to get lateral drainage of any fluid collections you got to see what kind of volume output you're getting from this thing, because many small leaks from the cystic duct will heal on their own without intervention in ERCP. So there are scenarios where I might recommend if you do a CT, the bile duct appears intact, there's a small collection under the liver, they would do a percutaneous drainage, avoid the ERCP, wait, see how that dries up, and then you can always get an MRI. But I think the most important thing is early recognition.
So I would add, besides knowing the anatomy, is, as Emily said in one of her slides, control the leakage. You don't want to reoperate in a field of bile, both because of the difficulty identifying the structures, and second of all, bile creates this inflammatory response that gives you a higher risk of stricture no matter what you do.
Yes, percutaneous drainage of any collection will allow that to drain out. The problem you see, though, in some of these cases, there's some fluid in the pelvis, a little bit of fluid between the bowel loops, and you don't have a collection to stick something in for. In those cases, when I'm pretty satisfied there's a leak with a HIDA scan, I will simply ask either the original surgeon, if he's in our institution, or myself, go back through the same holes and just place a drain up under the liver. Because I think lateral drainage is very important as the first step in treatment.
I think our time is up. I want to thank the audience for your attention. I want to thank Drs. Brunt, Winslow, and Vitale for a great panel. Thanks so much.